We didn't finish up the last class, or rather, Geshla didn't finish it up. We were talking about 18 kind of pledges you make to develop the good heart. So we'll finish that up, and then we'll start today's class. Number five, and these are at the end of the reading for the previous class. Number five is speak not of what was broken, meaning that you don't judge other people's practice, you know, and their motives. You don't talk about other people's apparent faults. And this means that we shouldn't pay attention to other people's mistakes. We just take care of our own behavior and thoughts. That's our job. You can judge other people's outer actions, but not their thoughts or motivations. And we've covered this, I think, in Bodhisattva vows. You know, if you see somebody being mugged on the street, you have to help them right away. You don't judge, well, maybe, you know, something's going on and I should help the attacker and not the person being attacked. You don't do that. We act on what we see, but without judging the motivations of the people involved. Number six is never worry about what they're doing. So we don't talk about or even think about other people's practice. There seems to be a pattern in Dharma centers, you know, that, you know, when people get together just chatting, the talk seems to turn toward what mistakes other people are making. It's sort of like, did you hear about so-and-so, you know, or do you know what that monk did? Things like that. But then there are some Dharma centers where this doesn't happen at all. And the energy in these centers is very clear. You know, it's what we might call smooth. Each person is doing their own book. So the thing is that we have to be pure ourselves, you know, and only worry about our own life, not the lives of others. When Geshla was talking about that, he says, we wouldn't think of putting an entry in somebody else's book, something that they should do, you know. So we don't talk about them either. We don't talk about other people's mistakes. We just worry about our own life, you know. Don't gossip, meaning the malicious kind of gossip. But there is good gossip, you know, the things that we talk about. Do you know what somebody did? You know, we're talking about something good they've done. That's really great. Number seven says, rid yourself of the biggest affliction first, which means go after your strongest mental affliction first. You know, don't focus on your second or third worst affliction. Go after the worst one. You know, we have to be honest with ourselves about that. And do that. As it turns out, we're taught this in the Abhisamya Alamkara, that our worst mental afflictions are gotten rid of by the weakest antidotes. The worst ones are very, very obvious to us. And they're the ones that we go after and really conquer. If we try to conquer, you know, third, fourth, fifth worst mental afflictions, we're probably going to have a hard time doing that. So we start with the worst one. And we sort of get a handle on that and tame it, and then we start on the next worst one, which is now the worst one because the what had been the worst one has kind of gone away. Number eight, never hope for any reward. You will get rewards if you practice well and you keep your vows and you meditate regularly. But don't expect instant results. And that's what this one is about. You know, it takes time for karma to ripen. So when you begin doing good things, you will see good results from that, but they may not happen for a while. So we shouldn't expect immediate results from what we do. Number nine says, stop eating poison food. And what poison food is watching out for number one. So we should all the time be thinking about what other people need. We don't watch out for ourselves. And then we think about how watching out for other people will help us in the long run. So that's what number nine is about. We don't eat poison food, meaning that what we take in is other people's concerns, not our own. Number 10 is don't let the stream flow smooth. And this has to do with what we do when we're having a mental affliction attack. This has to do with that we can't, you know, be a pushover for our mental afflictions. We have to put up some sort of fight. We have to put up resistance to our mental afflictions. We have a bodhisattva vow, you know, to not let a mental affliction go on. In the bodhisattva vow, this mainly has to do with anger, that we don't let moments of anger go on. So this one, don't let the stream flow smooth, has to do with getting, you know, of not putting up with mental afflictions when we're aware of them. We got to resist them. We got to put up a fight. As long as we put up a good fight, we don't break our bodhisattva vow. Even if the mental affliction wins in the end, as long as we put up a good fight, we don't break the vow. Number 11 is forget repaying criticism. And this is also one of our bodhisattva vows. You know, it's the one forgetting the four points of virtue, which means that we don't respond to four different kinds of things with the kind of thing that we got. So this one's about being criticized. When we're criticized, we don't return a criticism to the person who's criticizing us. We listen. They may be wrong, they may be right, but we pay attention. If they're right about something, we'll know it. And we should accept that. Number 12 is give up laying ambushes. So when somebody hurts us, you know, we don't plan to trap them and hurt them back. This also has to do with being happy when the person has something bad happen to them. We shouldn't do that. Number 13 is no going for the jugular. In a group of people, you know, when somebody else makes an error, don't expose them publicly by focusing on their faults. The Tibetan phrase for this point says, don't dig up an ant's nest. You know, if you dig up an ant's nest in the ground, there are ants running all over the place. And they may come, you know, sting you too. But this says, you know, just let things be. Don't expose other people's faults. This is particularly true for people that you don't like. You know, when somebody you don't like does something they shouldn't do, makes a mistake, it's our nature to say, ha, you know, and then just point it out to everybody else. See what they did? We shouldn't do that. It isn't having their best interests at heart, which is what we are supposed to do. This discussion in the text also says that we shouldn't evoke other spirits, you know, evil spirits, to do harm to them. And as bodhisattvas, we get to a point where we understand what spirits are, and we make offerings to them. We may even talk to them, and we ask them for things. but we shouldn't use them to hurt other people. Number 14, load your own truck. No passing the buck. Passing the buck is a nice American phrase about not taking responsibility. You know, just somebody, something needs to be done, you pass it on to somebody else. That's called passing the buck. We don't do that. So we don't try to place the blame for our mistakes on somebody else. We admit our errors freely. Yeah, I shouldn't have done that. I did it. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it. That was a mistake. It didn't work. You know, now Lojong behavior includes taking the blame for other people's mistakes. And just before we get real bodhicitta, we get an attitude of taking personal responsibility for all the troubles that anybody else is feeling. And that's an interesting thing. So real bodhicitta would, you know, be having in our heart the fact that we are going to get enlightened in order to help everybody else. And everything that we do is aimed at helping everybody else. And before that really sinks into us, we do get this personal this idea of personal responsibility, you know, that we take upon ourselves the responsibility for making other people's happy, you know, for taking away their pain. Number 15 is don't get fixed on speed. And this doesn't have to do with a drug. This is about cases where there's some opportunity for us to get what we want. You know, like you're at a vegetarian restaurant and a bowl gets passed around and there's a nice big piece of tofu down at the bottom and you happen to like tofu. Don't take it, you know. Give it to somebody else. So anytime the opportunity arises for you to get some gain for something just for yourself, don't do it. You know, give it to somebody else. Number 16 says, don't feed the wrong face. Lojong is supposed to starve your tendency to take care of yourself first. And rather, it's to take care of other people. So we have to be careful to not turn our Lojong practice into a means for feeding our mental afflictions, like pride or jealousy. Now, that's kind of a big jump there. We can use Lojong practice to feel proud about what we're doing, you know, that, yes, I'm a great bodhisattva. I'm giving this to somebody else. I don't take the first thing. I give it to somebody else. I'm not first in line. I'm last in line. So we have to be very, very careful about that. The jealousy part is becoming jealous when we see other people do what we're trying not to do. Or when we see other people doing, things that we're trying to do but don't do very well. That's what feeding the wrong face means. Number 17, don't turn the sweet angel to a devil. Lojong is the sweet angel, you know, of taking care of other people first. So we shouldn't do Lojong motivated by acting out of jealousy or desire or anger or pride or any such thing like that. Lojong is sweet. We honestly are putting other people before ourselves and taking care of them first. And if we do that with one of these mental afflictions, when that mental affliction is there, we're in a state of self-cherishing. So we have to be very careful. When the mental afflictions arise, get rid of them. And number 18, don't look for crap to make yourself happy. Meaning that we shouldn't derive pleasure from bad things that happen to people that we don't like. You know, this has to do with the ninth of the 10 non-virtues. don't think that their bad fortune confirms your negative view of them. We shouldn't do this. This ill will, you know, harmful intent, that is the ninth non-virtue, is a horrible thing to have. If we're happy, you know, when somebody else has something bad happen to them, we're in a terrible state. It's a really kind of a sick state. It's something that bodhisattvas just plainly can't tolerate. And we get in those moods. So when they occur, just get rid of them. So that ends class number 5. So now we can start on class number 6, freedom from the 4 attachments. Deshla said he considers this the greatest Lojong teaching by one of the greatest Lojong writers of all time. So, let's say Shenpa Shidrel. Shenpa Shidrel.
Shenpa Shidrel.
Shenpa Shidrel.
Shenpa Shidrel.
Shenpa Shidrel.
Shenpa Shidrel.
Yeah, that drell is where your tongue's curled back. Drell, drell. Yeah. Shenpa means attachment. She is 4, and drell means freedom. So as Buddhists, you know, we're not supposed to have attachments, but we do. There are lots of teachings showing us what attachments are and how to begin to get rid of them. And in this text, we'll explore what attachments are. We really have to know what they are. You know, we talk about them, but do we really know what they are? You know, what an attachment is and what it does to us. And we'll, in this text, are going to be looking at 4 different types of attachment. And then we'll look at how to get rid of them. But first, we have a story. In the early years in Tibet, monks would come into Tibet from India. They wore strange clothes and they spoke a funny language. And they talked about strange things like attachment and emptiness. Geshe-la told us that in the monastery at Saramay, you know, when recently arrived Tibetan refugees would enter the monastery, they would say things like, "I came a family that had 14 yaks." Or our family had 114 sheep, something like that. And when I was trekking in the Himalayas, you know, villages were characterized by the number of stone buildings they had. You know, like this is a 10-house village or an 8-house village or an 80-house village, you know. The 80-house village was what we'd consider a small city. The yards there had stone walls around them. Some of those walls were tall enough to hide the house, except you could see the house through the gate. And the gate was always kept open, at least during the daylight. I suspect that they were closed during the night. So Tibetans liked things, you know, and they measured themselves by the things that they had. So here come these strange people who had climbed over the Himalayas and started talking about how things have no nature of their own and that we shouldn't measure ourselves by things that we have and things that we have that don't really exist. So these lamas started Dharma centers, and one of them was named, one of the lamas who came was named Khun Khunchok Gyalpo. Khun Khunchok Gyalpo. And he was born in 1034. We don't know when he died. And he started as a Dharma center, you know, just like people like you are doing now. And he chose a place for his center on a hillside. The dirt there had kind of a chalky white soil, sort of dusty. And Khunchok Gyalpo then had a son named Josie Jumpel. And Josie Jumpel took over the Dharma Center when his dad died. And Josie Jumpel was practicing pretty well, and the Dharma Center was getting stronger. Now, at this time, there were no monks or nuns in Tibet. So everybody at the Dharma Centers were lay people. Then Josie Jumple had a son called Kungan Ningpo. And Kungan Ningpo's dates are 1092 to 1158. And he is known as Sakya Kungan Ningpo. So he's, Sachen. Sachen Kungan Ningpo. So say Sachen Kungan Ningpo.
Sachen Kungan Ningpo.
Sachen Kungan Ningpo.
Sachen
means great Sakya. Kunga means happiness. And Kunga is the Tibetan name for one of Lord Buddha's disciples called Ananda. And Ningpo means essence. So we've got Sachen Kunga Ningpo. And now there's another character that comes into this mix of characters. And his name is Bari Lotsawa. Say Bari.
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 Yeah, Bari.
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 Lotsawa means translator.
Lotsawa.
And Lotsawas were Tibetans who had learned Sanskrit. And they translated the Sanskrit texts that were coming, that lamas were bringing from India. They translated them into Tibetan. And they were the same kind of people who were today learning Tibetan. It took 700 years to translate the Sanskrit text into Tibetan. And the Tibetan texts are now known as the Kangyur and the Tengyur. The Kangyur are the texts that were spoken by Lord Buddha, and the Tengyur are the commentaries written by the Indian commentators. 700 years. There were hundreds of Lotsawas. And it took them that long. So we have the same task today. We've got to translate Tibetan into whatever our language is. So we need hundreds of translators in each of these languages. And we have not just the Tibetan text to translate, but we're now discovering Sanskrit texts that never made it out of Tibet. They were taken there, maybe not translated. But then lost, they were burned, and we're discovering some of these in India now, and we're discovering Sanskrit texts that were translated, that were lost in Tibet, and it's nice to take these and check them against the Tibetan translations. So we need translators. Right now, there are just a handful of translators, and most of these are in universities. You know, and they're translating the Tibetan into sort of an intellectual English or German or Russian or Spanish or whatever. It's the kind of language that will satisfy PhD communities in the committees in the universities, because most of the translating being done is for PhD theses. So we need translators. Hint, hint, hint. So in Tibet at this time, Lotsawas were very important people in the Dharma centers. And Bari was one of the best that there was. So here is Bari Lotsawa hanging out in this little Dharma center on the side of a white dusty hill. And Kungan Ningpo is born in the center. So by the time Kungan Ningpo is like 12 years old, he's spending most of his time with Bari Lotsawa. Bari Lotsawa tells Kungan Ningpo that his father is a great man, you know, and that Kungan Ningpo his father owns the Dharma Center, you know, and he tells Kungan Ningpo that he will have to do his father proud and develop wisdom. So he gives Kungan Ningpo secret teachings, showing him how to enter another realm and receive wisdom teachings from enlightened beings. It's sort of like that English book called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where a little girl enters a closet, you know, and she meets miraculous beings. So, of course, when Kungan Ningpo starts this practice, he has obstacles to the practice. And, in fact, he meets some beings, but they're the wrong ones. They're not good beings to have met. But instead of freaking out, he keeps on trying. And Bari Lotsawa then shows him a practice to do to overcome the obstacles. And eventually, Kungan Ningpo meets Manjushri face to face, and he receives teachings from Manjushri. Now, Kunga Ningpo is still 12 years old, and one of the things that Manjushri grants him is the teaching of the freedom from the four attachments. So Kunga Ningpo goes on to become a great lama himself, and the center flourishes. Kunga Ningpo names it for the place where it's located, Sakya. Sa means place, and Kya actually means not having a distinguishing color, but sort of a whitish-gray kind of thing. So we say that Sakya means white place or white mountain. And that and what is now the great Sakya tradition started at the Sakya Dharma Center. The Dharma Center became a monastery, and it's still there, thriving. It was not destroyed by the Chinese. So Sachin Kunga Ningpo had a son named Jetsun Dakpa Gyeltsen, and his dates are 1147 to 1216. And Sakya Kunga Ningpo passed on his knowledge to Jetsun Dakpa Gyeltsen, including the freedom for the four attachments. And by the way, our Vajrayogini lineage entered Tibet through Sachin Kunga Ningpo and then Jetsun Drakpa Gyeltsen. So Jetsun Drakpa Gyeltsen wrote a commentary on freedom from the four attachments. And he had a nephew named Sakya Pandita Kunga Gyeltsen. His dates are 1182 to 1251. Pandita, by the way, is from the Sanskrit pundit, which means scholar. And the Tibetans just took that name, and it came for them, Pandita. And in English now we have the word pundit, except it's spelled P-U-N-D-I-T instead of P-A-N-D-I-T. So Sakya Pandita is one of the greatest lamas ever in Tibet, and he became the lineage holder for Jetsun Drakpa Gyeltsen. And he wrote many books. He was a master logician. He translated many Sanskrit texts. He memorized the 8,000-verse Perfection of Wisdom text that's in the Kangyur. And he went to Mongolia to the court of Kublai Khan. Kublai Khan had died a little earlier, but it was still known as the court of Kublai Khan. The Mongolians at this time had grown into a huge nation. You know, they'd conquered and occupied Moscow, and they'd conquered and occupied Beijing and places in between. They'd gone all the way to Arabia and Eastern Europe. But they never attacked Tibet. The Tibetan leaders had told the Khan, you know, look, we'll pay you some money every year. Just leave us alone. And the Khan said, okay. But when the Khan died, his successor, who was Prince Godan, began to get familiar with the reaches of the kingdom, and he spent some time around the border of Tibet. And he got a little bit interested in Buddhism. So, in a typical princely fashion, he found out who was the greatest Tibetan Lama and sent him a letter saying, you are invited to come to the court to teach me Buddhism. If you don't, I will burn every monastery in eastern Tibet. So, Sakya Pandita sets out for Mongolia. Now, he's around 60 years old at this time, which was about 20 years older than the average lifespan of a Tibetan then. So he's old. And he takes along two nephews who are young. One of them was 9 years old when they started out. And along the way, everybody begs Sakya Pandita to teach while he's there. He enters a village to stay overnight, and they say, please teach, please teach. And, of course, he would. And this trip now is stretching into 2 or 3 years, and the prince is getting very impatient. So Sakyapandita sends his two nephews ahead to placate the prince. And when Sakyapandita finally arrives at the court in Mongolia, his nephews have already converted the prince to Buddhism. The court is now practicing Buddhism, and Mongolia becomes a Buddhist nation. Now, the name of the nephew who did most of the work is Drogon Chögyal Pakpa. Pakpa means superior, right, Arya? His dates are 1238 to 1280. So by the time he gets to Mongolia, he's like 11, maybe 12 years old, and he and his cousin, maybe brother, I don't know, are the ones who convert Mongolia to Buddhism. And then when Drogon Chögyal Pakpa gets a little older, he's a young adult, he begins to wander around the borders of Mongolia, and he winds up in Beijing, where he becomes the Lama of Kublai Khan. Now, as I understand it, Kublai Khan had died at this point, but Geshe-la said it was Kublai Khan. Maybe it's another Kublai Khan. Anyway, there's a Mongolian emperor at the court in Beijing. And Drogon Chögyal Pakpa becomes his lama. And while he's there, he meets this Italian named Marco Polo. And then he travels other places as well. Later, Drogon Chögyal Pakpa invents a written language for Mongolian. It's based on the Tibetan alphabet. And the Mongolians then begin to teach Dharma to the people they've captured. The armies along the fronts at the borders, the extent of the kingdom, begin to teach Buddhism to the people they've just captured or about to capture or haven't captured yet but are kind of interested. And by the late 1700s, the Mongolians were no longer interested in having a large empire, and they began to withdraw their armies. Now, there was a sizable Mongolian presence in Russia at this time. And when the armies left, there were some civilian Mongolians there. They wanted to leave too, but they didn't leave with the armies because they weren't army. And they wrote the Dalai Lama in Tibet, asking him when would be a good date for them to leave. And the Dalai Lama gave them a date. Now, by this time it was winter. And a few days before the designated departure date, a warm spell hit, and it unfroze the river. And those Mongolians on the western side couldn't cross. So they stayed in Russia. The word Kalmuk, which is a name of these Mongolians, is said by some people to mean left behind or stuck there. And these Mongolians were good fighters, and they fought for the Russians in World War II. And eventually they get to South America and New Mexico of the United States. And they don't like New Mexico, or South America for that matter. And they eventually moved to New Jersey, where there had been some Mongolians who had settled there earlier. And these Mongolians had established a temple. And there was a lama there called Geshe Wangyal. And he had students, people like Jeffrey Hopkins and Robert Thurman and Joshua Cutler. And then when Geshe Wangyal passed, His Holiness sent a Geshe named Geshe Lozong Tarchin for 3 years to go to New Jersey and become a lama there. Well, some Americans begin to come to the center, and they ask for teachings. And they ask for, you know, Geshe Tarchin to stay, and he does. He never went back to India. And you know the rest of the story. So your lineage is Sakya, you know, both in the open teachings and in the secret teachings. My first Buddhist experience was at a Sakya center in the hills just east of San Francisco. And the Lama there was Lama Kunga, Kunga's a great Sakya name, I guess. And he was the line of a long line of Kungas passed on from father to son. I saw a picture of his grandfather, his father, and him in a book in a photograph in a book that was published by an American newscaster sometime in the 40s, before the Chinese got there. And Lama Kunga is maybe a teenager, maybe even younger than that. But he looks exactly like he did when I met him. And oddly enough, Geshe-la invited this Lama Kunga to come to Diamond Mountain and consecrate the land. Lama Kunga and one of the Lama. I thought that was very, very interesting. So these Lamas that we've been talking about, they are known as the five great Sakya patriarchs. This is on your homework. So I didn't tell you about one of the patriarchs because he's in our secret lineage only. You can look in the class notes to find out his name and dates. So now we're ready to talk about freedom from the four attachments. And I'll read you the text. A person who is still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. A person who is still attached to the three worlds has no renunciation. A person who is still attached to getting what they want is no bodhisattva. A person who still grasps to things has no worldview. And that's the text. Four lines. When I was in Italy, I stayed one summer there. Sakya Treason came, and he taught us this text over 3 days. And after he'd done this sort of introduction and everything else, he just read the text in English. He taught it in English. And there was the earth kind of trembled when he did it. Sakya Treason, he's as big as I am, a little bit broader. He's not fat, but he's a big man. And he has this very quiet voice. But yet when he read these lines very quietly, there was this, kind of stuff going on under there. So basically, this Lojong is summarized in the first line. A person who's still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. So what does it mean not to be attached to things, not to be attached to this life? So we're considering life here to be ourselves, our existence, us and the things that we use, the things that we have. Most people think that not being attached means that we can enjoy anything. And this is not what it means. Attached means that you put your trust in things. You think that things these things can bring you what you want, And we know that this is not true. We really have to internalize that within ourselves, though. So attachment is not latte or chocolate cake or even the Buddha paradise, You can enjoy things. That's the whole point of our practice, But if you think that these things have a nature of their own and by themselves they can bring you happiness, that is attachment. So that's kind of the thing that Lojong is talking about. Now, these are the words, These are Manjushri's first words to Pakpa, 12 years old. Now, Pakpa's already a great Buddhist, but just kind of think about what that must have meant to him, to hear these things. The first thing, when he finally meets this being, which has got to be a startling thing in and of itself, if you have attachment to this life, you're not a Dharma practitioner. So, you know, we think about this. The joys of this life are a tiny indication of what could happen when we reach enlightenment. And the whole point of life is to reach total ecstasy and bliss. But Dharma students who want to become masters of Buddhism during their student years have to suffer. People who are attached to small pleasures can never attain this great ecstasy that is the point of our practice. And learning to separate ourselves from being attached to these things is a horrible experience. It's painful. Lama Christy said it's like having your skin ripped off of you. We have to understand through studying emptiness that these things we're attached to have no nature of their own. We have to understand that deeply, that they cannot give us what we want. And once we understand that, we have renunciation. And then we can begin to practice. Remember that the entrance to the Buddhist path, the very first one, the path of accumulation, is renunciation. So we have to have that. We have to give up being attached to the things that we have, which includes our family and friends. And it includes the Dharma as well, believe it or not. It includes the correct understanding of emptiness. Abhisamaya Alamkara points that out too. We get a correct understanding of emptiness and we become attached to that. We think that that is self-existent. And it's not. We have to give that up too. So what we choose to do in our daily life is an indication of whether or not we're attached to this life. You know, making the right choice about what to dedicate your life to is freedom from attachment. If you dedicate your life to helping others first, then that's freedom from attachment to this, to your life, to the things, to watching out for number one and being attached to the things that you have. So we have to be very careful about this. We have to understand that we need to spend our life making sure that we're separated from any of the four bases of what we might call attachment. And what are those four bases? That's what these four attachments really are. The first one is called bakchak, which we've had before. Bakchak means seed or imprint, potentiality. Geshe-la here uses the term instincts. We keep our morality and we keep the civilized behavior because we have a sort of a natural inner sense, you know, that stops us from killing people that irritate us, for example. It stops us from taking the last donut on the plate. It's our good instincts come from the good seeds that we've planted, and we need to stamp out the bad instincts, which is watching out for number one. So we begin to trust in these good instincts that we're developing. If we're trusting in our normal instincts, then we have attachment to this life. So we go through this process of beginning to look at what we normally do and then begin to do the opposite. And after we've done that for a while, then our instincts change too. Our good nature is impermanent, and it will slide, you know, when things get tough for us. So even after we've developed good instincts, you know, if we don't keep renewing those, then they'll go away and the old ones will reappear. So we've got to be vigilant, you know. So this first one is instincts, bakchaks, the imprints that come from things that we've done. The second basis for attachment is called tsorwa, or feelings. Feelings is the second heap. We have to keep our ethics when it feels good. And we do that, you know. But when we need something badly or we need to feel good, then we'll let those slide and do something to get what we want. We may even know sort of in the back of our minds that it's not going to do us any good. But we let the ethics kind of slide there. So this is one of the bases for attachment is our feelings. They're different from our instincts. The instincts are patterns of behavior, attitudes, we could say. The feelings are this feeling of need or emptiness or loneliness or something like that. Desire even, you know, that when things get hard for us, that we want to be comforted for that, from that. And we go after things that will make us happy. And we have to fight that. The third one is called Lukzul. These are the customs of our country. What are those? Well, gambling, lottery, drinking alcohol, smoking, abortion, adultery, hunting animals, and so forth. You know, these things, some of them are illegal, some of them are encouraged. We can't trust our country's value system to be a guide for our own ethical behavior. But we can fall back on this, you know. Well, this is what our country is, this is what our civilization says we should do. So I'm going to do it. And we don't even think about that. These would be things that were taught in school. Probably not taught explicitly, some of them are. But things that we just learn to do from our friends, from what we read, from television, and so on and so forth. And we have to watch out for those. And then the fourth basis, pa-ma, which is mother and father. This is the morality of our parents. This is what we learned to do when we were growing up because of the way our parents behaved or what they taught us in the home. About half of what we believe is some kind of silly things that our parent taught us, you know, when and we never really seriously examined those things. My mother was really kind of a racial bigot. She clothed it very nicely and sweetly, but it would, you know, sort of leak out at times in very nice ways. A good friend of hers had married a nice Jewish boy, for example. And, you know, we come across these kind of things, and we have to begin to look at them. We've never examined them, you know. They just seem normal to us, and we have to do that. So those are sort of the four bases that form the attachments that we have. So to live a moral life, you know, based on Buddhist ethics, we're often going to have to go against, you know, what we were brought up to believe. You know, for example, you know, it's crazy to work your whole life without sufficient time to devote to your spiritual goals. But I was brought up, you know, you go to college, you get a job, and you spend your life doing that. You supply money for your family, and then you retire. You know, that's what my parents did. I think during my entire childhood and youth, up to the time I was in college, we took two vacations, and that was it. You know, two times did we actually go someplace for a couple of weeks. My father worked all the time. They were brought up in the Depression. They were afraid of being poor. And they kept their money. They didn't spend much of it. And they were going to use it when they retired. And when my father retired, my mother died. You know, and it was, the whole thing was just sort of a waste of time for him. And he regretted it instantly, and there was nothing he could do about it. And so these are kind of things we have to look at, you know. We have to find time to meditate, for example, to do our practice. We can't let our jobs rule our spiritual life. And separating from that can take some time. I know that you all have done it, and you probably need to do more of it. But some of your students won't have done it, and you've got to encourage them to do it and have them be patient at the same time. Almost everybody I know that's been around Geshe-la for a while has reached a point where they have jobs. Many of them are retired. They've made enough money, but if they have jobs, they can take 2 or 3 months off a year to do retreat, for example, or to do other things. Geshe-la is holding these Lam Rim retreats 4 times a year. They're a week, 10 days long. And the same people come to them over and over, you know, from everywhere in the world. And those things begin to happen if you're leading a good life. And one of the things we have to do is separate from our attachments to the way that we have done things. Our civilization creates people, you know, whose only meaningful goal is to die with a bunch of possessions that we can't use. Freedom from attachment to this life means to think independently. That's another thing, you know. We have to examine the standard of our behavior against our understanding of karma and emptiness, not against our instincts, our feelings, our culture, or our parents' values. So this is what we do. An ideal lifestyle might be to do our daily practice until 1 o'clock, you know, and then we work until 6. And then we take 2 months off during the year for retreats. Something like that. Now, it's also true that most of the people I know that have been around Geshe-la for a while, whatever they do is their practice. Their work becomes their practice. Their families, if they have them, become their practice. Their loved ones become their practice. And Lojong is really about doing that kind of thing. How do we do it? And separating from the four attachments, these four bases we just talked about, is what we have to, it's sort of a yardstick that we use to measure what we're doing. It's what we compare ourselves to. And after a while, we're doing this several times a day. In class next week, we're going to talk about death meditation. And one of the things we do in death meditation is develop the habit, is what I'm going to die today, is what I'm doing right now the best thing I could be doing. And that's the death meditation part. Lojong takes it a little bit higher than that. So that's the class for today. And if